Good morning, church. Good morning. I know it's already into January, but let me wish you a happy new year. My first time to be able to greet you in such a way. And in like 3 or 4 days, January will be halfway over. That's hard to believe. If you're joining us online, we're so glad to have you with us from wherever you're joining, from your living room here in Murfreesboro, or maybe at one of our assisted living facilities, or maybe in a country far across the globe. We are thrilled to have you with us and would love to have you back. And if you're visiting with us here today, I know I see some college students that are still in before their semester begins. We're thrilled always to see you all. We're glad to have you all with us, and what a blessing to have a full house this morning. I hope you're feeling good. You're going to have to extend me a little bit of grace this morning because I'm going to do something a little bit different to start off, but when you ask the youth minister to preach, you know what you signed up for. And so I'm going to get a couple of volunteers. I've asked Anthony and Aaron, if you all would come up here. Aaron and Anthony, come on up. And we're going to welcome them to the stage, everybody, as they come on up. And just come and stand right over here, right there, Anthony and Aaron, right here. We're going to watch the screen because you're going to need to look at the screen. The audience can look back there, but Aaron, come stand over here. We're going to play a little game that we call What Came First? Okay, we're doing our series First Things. I wanted to wake everybody up this morning. I know that we need to kind of get some energy going here. So I'm going to show you two things. You're going to pick which came first. Now, don't be influenced by the other person's answer. You're going to go stand over there if you think it's that one, or over here if you think it's this one. After the first one, it'll be very easy, okay? You all can play along by pointing if you'd like to and show people how smart you are, but just don't shout the answer out. Don't tell them where to go. Here is your first one. Kmart or Walmart? Which one came first? Just move around the room. Go ahead and go. Okay. All right. We already have a division here, and it's a Kmart. So, Anthony, you score the first point. So just keep up with your own score there, and you guys can continue to play here. Here we go. Which came first, Star Wars or Starbucks? Star Wars or Starbucks? They're going to both go over there, okay? And the answer is Starbucks. They're both wrong. They're both wrong. All right. So which came first, Monopoly or Clue? Which of these came first? All right, very good. You guys are moving around well. That is Monopoly. You guys both got that right. Okay, very good. Which one is first, Superman or Batman? Which came first, Superman or Batman? Okay, all right, very good. This is the fastest I've seen you guys move in a long time. And it is Superman. You got that one right. Okay, all right, here we go. Which came first, Betty White or sliced bread? Okay, all right, here we go. It is, in fact, Betty White. It is, in fact, Betty White. Or, so as my daughter Lila May said at dinner the other night, she was like, so you're saying that Betty White was the best thing until sliced bread. So there we go. Which one, Toll House chocolate chip cookies or Oreos? Which came first? Okay, there is a buzz in the room, and you guys are both wrong. All right, which came first, the electric razor or the lie detector? The electric razor or the lie detector? Okay, we're going to both come over here, and you guys are right. All right, that is, I'm being honest. Which came first, the iPod or the USB drive? The USB drive or the iPod? And go, Aaron. Okay, got it. We go. They got it, and they are both wrong again. Okay. And then our last one, basketball or baseball? Which one came first? They both feel confident, and of course, they are right. You guys did a great job. Let's give them a hand. They did a nice job. Thank you. Okay, all right. So I just wanted to give us a little bit of energy in the room, kind of get some blood flowing, and then make a point. And here's the point. I didn't know that we didn't rehearse this, and obviously they did not know the answers ahead of time. Here's the point. The point is, it's a challenge to put first things first. It's a challenge to know which thing goes before the other. In a game like this, and certainly in our lives. We're going to illustrate that in a number of ways this morning. Wordle, before it became a game that most of us played on our phones to begin or end each day, was a website that you could take a text and put it into a program, and it would create a word cloud. Wordle.net was a program, and some of you may be familiar with Wordle. This is a Wordle of an issue of the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, I think, actually. And they took every word in that particular issue, ran it through Wordle, and you can see what stories were more important in that particular issue. Or, for example, here is a Wordle of the Gettysburg Address. Now, by now you've figured out how this works. The words that appear more often are larger than the other words. So you can begin to see what's important. Now, for our younger ones in the room, this is a Wordle, or word cloud, of Frozen. Yeah, the plot of the script of Frozen. Now, you're going to begin to notice something with a story. The way you all knew the answer to that is because you saw what? Names, right? You saw names of characters, and you realized, I know what that is. This is a Wordle of Star Wars. A little tougher, but this is a word cloud of Lord of the Rings. Very good. The reason you know that is because the names of the characters that are prominent jump out at you, and because they play a big role in the story. And that was a giveaway on at least those last three, because you know the story and you know the character. Well, now let's take this and put it into Scripture. If we put it into Scripture and we go to the book of Genesis, this is a Wordle of the book of Genesis. Now let's continue on through the first five books, and you're going to begin to see a pattern. This is the book of Exodus. Now we see a name that jumps out, but notice we see a word even more prominent. We go from Genesis to Exodus into Leviticus. We look at the book of Numbers. We look at the book of Deuteronomy. You begin to see a pattern. You begin to see that the name of the character, the one who comes first, jumps out at you, and it's clear. There's no mistaking. Even when you go into the book of Joshua, the series that we just finished recently, even though it's about a man named Joshua, his name appears a whole lot, he still does not come first in the story. We go to the New Testament, and we're going to see the same pattern, the Gospel of Matthew. And now we have the Gospel of Mark. We have the Gospel of Luke. And now we have the Gospel of John. You begin to see now, we know who comes first in this story. In fact, if we show the entire Old Testament, all the books of the Old Testament, all the books of the New Testament, it becomes so very clear what comes first and who is first. Now, if you did a word cloud, say, of your life, everything that you said this week, everything that you posted, everything that you said in conversation, every phone conversation, and you put all that down. This was from a random student, a college student in Texas, so you're going to see some things like Texans and Cowboys. But they took everything that this person posted and put it through a word cloud, and this was the Wordle. You begin to see what are the most important things in the conversation of this person over a given week. Now, we would love for our conversation to look like this. If somebody took everything that you said and posted or wrote and put into, or even thought, and put it into a word cloud, this is what we would like. But it probably would not look like this. Why? Because it is difficult to put first things first. That's why we start this series on first things. We started it last week. There's four total Sundays in the month. Four first things. Like, let's go back to basics. It's a challenge to put first things first. Ted Collins is somebody you probably wouldn't know, but we owe something pretty significant to Ted. Ted was the producer of the Kate Smith Radio Hour, which ran from 1936 to 1945. Kate Smith was the first lady of radio. She is the one who boosted morale during the Depression, during World War II. She's the one who introduced the nation to the song God Bless America in 1938 on her radio program. And she also gave many performers and musicians their start in radio. Especially a comedy duo that the producer said, I saw these guys, I think we should put them on and give them some exposure. They would go on to have quite a successful career and their own radio show, two guys that we know as Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. Ted Collins almost made a pretty fatal mistake. He said to these guys, you guys can come on, I've seen your stuff, I've seen your routines, I love them, you can do any you want, except don't do the baseball routine. That one is not funny, and we don't want that one on the air. Had Ted Collins got his way, I probably would not have this sitting in my office. If you come to my office, you'll see this here. And when it's plugged in, you push the red button, it does the entire routine. It won't stop until you unplug it. As I learned with my girls when they were younger, they loved to watch Abbott and Costello. Their mouths move, their heads move, they turn around. It's pretty fascinating to watch. And I got eventually tired of it. It was like, unplug it, say, girls, it broke. It doesn't work anymore. But of course, I'm talking about their routine that we know as what? Who's on first? Who's on first was in 1999, Time Magazine said it was the best comedy sketch of the 20th century. Who's On first appeared in 1938 when it was performed on this show. In 2003, the Library of Congress took 50 audio recordings that they thought were so significant in the history of our country and put them started a collection, an archive of sound recordings. Among the first 50 were the Hindenburg disaster, Bing Crosby's rendition of White Christmas, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 I Have a Dream speech, and the entire recording of Abbott and Costello's Who's On First. Among the top 50 that wanted to be enshrined for American history, in 2005, the American Film Institute said it was one of the 100 greatest movie lines of all time because they did the routine in one of their movies, listing it as 91st of the 100 greatest quotes in the history of cinema, Who's On First. And so that's the title of the message this morning, is Who's On First. I found out that something I didn't know, that in 1956, they were enshrined into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. This gold record recording is on display, and an audio recording loops in the museum, making them two of a very, very short list of non-baseball professionals in the Hall of Fame. There's obviously coaches and managers and umpires and announcers, but Abbott and Costello are among a very, very short list of two people that really had nothing to do with baseball in the Hall of Fame. I mean, it captured the attention of our entire country. So the title of this morning is Who's On First. Why? Because as the routine shows, it's very confusing to figure out who is in fact on first. To put first things first is a challenge that we have. I'm not talking about comedy routines or the game we just played, but I'm talking about our life. So we started this series last week. Kelvin did a great job of kicking us off with this passage from the book of Colossians, or actually Paul's letter to the Colossian Christians in Colossae. I like to refer to them as letters because with our students sometimes I think we realize these guys weren't writing books of the Bible. They were writing letters to people that they cared about. And he says, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Colossians makes one point. Colossians says it is difficult to get first things first. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. We started that last week with the very first of the first things. Now, I was challenged with a second first thing, and it was listed in our preaching planning team as vertical adoration. Now, that can be a little confusing. You can kind of piece together what that means, but I'm going to reword it just a little bit. If last week's was Jesus is Lord, like we have to start with that. That's fundamental. Jesus is Lord. Then the second of the first things is Jesus is worthy of our worship, vertical adoration. If you're with me so far, say, I got it. Okay, let's keep moving. So Paul writes to his friends in Philippi, and he says, what is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing, what's the next word, church? Worth of knowing Christ, Jesus, my Lord. Worth. We assign worth-ship to things that are of great value, and that's where our word worship comes from, the idea of assigning great worth, all-surpassing worth. I'll try to think of a way to illustrate that, and I'm always looking in life for things that say this is kind of like that, and I just found one on Christmas morning in our home. This is a bag from Anthropologie, and my wife received a gift on Christmas morning that left me a little confused and bewildered. Now, if you are staying in tune with pop culture, which I don't expect everybody in this room to do so, does anybody have a clue or a hint at what they think is about to come next? Raise your hand if you say, I think I know what's about to happen. I see some hands. The others of you are like, she got a gift. So what? My wife opened the gift, and when she opened it, it was this rock. Yes, it's a rock. And my wife was visibly moved to the point of tears when she unwrapped this gift. I looked at her and thought, she is really touched by this gift. I was about to give her a string of pearls that I got for Christmas and to celebrate our 30th anniversary, and I'm thinking, there's no way these pearls are going to get the reaction of this rock. What I didn't know is that in September, Phoebe Adams came up with a prank. She pranked her significant other by getting a rock that she told her significant other was from Abercrombie, and he looked at it and realized the cost of this thing. You know, you paid $1,000. She said, no, it was on sale, and she just got his reaction to this rock being a part of their home decor. She's like, I'm going to put it right here. It's going to be so lovely. And then it went viral, and people everywhere started giving rocks from Anthropology to their spouses, and everybody was in on it except for one person. And so this particular Sunday, Christmas morning, I got to be the fall guy. So I wanted to show the video. My family did not give me permission to show the video. They said, no, Dad, we're in our pajamas. We hadn't gotten ready yet. Like, you are not showing it. And so I'm sorry. The video is not going to be posted online for the world to see, but you can find many of them. But this is the first picture of me looking and thinking, everybody in the room reacted, what's so special about this rock? This next picture is when my wife says, isn't it beautiful? And she hands me the rock, and I look at it, and I'm looking for a fossil of early life inside of it. I'm looking for the autograph of Benjamin Franklin or something that says, this is Plymouth rock, or this is a part of, I don't know what I was thinking, the Great Wall of China. I'm not sure. I was looking at something, trying to figure out what. This is me still amused and perplexed at what's going on as my wife says, I can't believe you all did this. And Daisy, my daughter, makes it a point of saying, Mom, you need to know we all chipped in. All three of us chipped in. I'm like, I'm looking around. She says, we all chipped in. We knew it was your anniversary. We want to do something special. She kept saying we all chipped in. The next picture is me still, as my brother is surreptitiously filming, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Like, I don't understand. It is a rock. I was looking at my sons-in-law, and I was like, we're going to be rich, guys. I got 50 of these in the backyard lining a path. They're going on eBay, like, right now after we go. This is, I'm still thinking, I'm looking at a rock, and my wife's like, I don't know where I'm going to put it. She's still crying. I found out later, to keep herself from laughing, she cried and was walking around the room. She didn't want to make eye contact with me. I'm still going, trying to figure this out. I still have no idea. And then my dad hands me the phone. My dad was not in on it, but he was so confused. What's the deal with this rock? He looked it up and realized it was a viral prank. He thought maybe they were pranking my wife, and he said, hey, you better let her in on this. Like, she's getting one pulled over on her. And I was like, Dad, that's not what's happening here. And then, of course, we all had a great laugh, and everybody died laughing. And the number of times my daughter said, we all chipped in. We wanted to do something really special for you. And then they gave the rock to go to Elijah's house and do it with his parents, and then to grandparents, and then to somebody else's uncle. The rock, I have no idea where the rock is now. I want that rock back. I want it back in my office. And as I'm sitting there looking at it, I'm like, okay. And then it hit me. I was like, yeah, you know what? This will preach. I need this rock back. Psalm 62, truly my soul finds rest in God. My salvation comes from him. Truly he is my rock and my salvation. See, that Christmas morning, my girls were trying to convince me of the great value of this rock that, in fact, had no value at all. And I wasn't buying it until I did buy it. And then I thought, well, I didn't pay for it, so I don't really care. But I just thought, how's this rock going to compare to these pearls I'm about to give her? She is really impressed by this rock. But church, we are in a world very similar where we are trying to convince the world of the value of a rock that has great value that they see no value in. And that's difficult to do because it's tough to put first things first. The psalmist would go on to say this, I will never be shaken. He's my fortress. Yes, my soul finds rest in him. My hope comes from him. Truly, he is my rock and my salvation. He says it again. My fortress, I won't be shaken. My salvation and my honor depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your hearts to him, for he is our refuge. The psalmist writes about a rock that is valuable. And the psalmist begins to experience what we would know as vertical adoration, directing all praise vertically. All right, so if you're still with me so far, say, I got it. All right, we've kind of gone a lot of ways to get here. And then on New Year's Day, I set a resolution that in January I was going to read through the Psalms. Somebody said, you know, if you read 5 Psalms a day, you can get through the 150 Psalms by the end of the month. So I started reading 5 Psalms a day, and I noticed something very quickly. I noticed that my mood and my spirit was affected by what I was reading. In fact, when I made I didn't make this chart, but I looked it up because I was like, all of these Psalms, you have Psalms of praise and you have Psalms of lament, but all of them are aimed vertically and pouring out something to God. There are some that talk about our joint worship and our congregational gathering. But there's hymns, and psalms of trust and thanksgiving. But so many of them, almost all the psalms, are pointing vertically. Vertical adoration. That's our second first thing. On the fifth day of January, I got to Psalm 25. I was trying to catch up. I was on a plane flying to Arizona, and I was reading Psalm 25, and I thought, this looks familiar. And then I realized, you know what? This is the song, one of the first songs I ever learned in my youth group when I became a seventh grader. They did have songs then, guys. And when I was in the seventh grade, we had little folders with notes in them, and we'd pass those out at our devos. We didn't have PowerPoint. We barely even had overheads yet. And we were just learning the songs from these folders, and we sang the Psalm 25, the version of this from the King James Version. Some of you see these lyrics, and they look familiar, don't you? Right? You know the song. How many of you know the song? It's the song, Unto Thee, O Lord. Now, I have no idea how David intended for it to sound. I'm curious when we get to heaven if David's going to say to us in the new heavens and the new earth, you know, hey, that Psalm 34, like, man, y'all really killed it. That was awesome. Like, that's better than mine. But on this one over here or that one over there, like, sorry. My version was better. I have no idea what they were meant to sound like. But this is one of the first songs that I sang. I asked the praise team if we could just practice a couple of it here to understand vertical adoration. Imagine the psalmist sitting under a tree writing, and he writes these words. If you know it, sing along. Unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. Unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in thee. Memories of being at church camp or being on a retreat or being in somebody's house on a Thursday night devotional that we had every week in my youth group. And I think about these moments, and I love that song. It's vertical adoration. Somebody said that with pop music, there's only really four messages of any pop love song. It's either I love you or I hate you, go away or come back. It's like any song, that's it. It's one of those four. Pick your song. But with the Psalms, it's thousands of ways of expressing this adoration. Now, this slide's a little strange, I'll give you. But let's imagine for a second that I give you a time machine in a DeLorean, and I allow you to go back to any moment in the Bible and come back and tell us about it. What would you pick? It's a great icebreaker question. And most of you would say, I'm just going to take off the crucifixion and resurrection. I'm going to take those off the table, because I would imagine that everybody wants to pick those. So let's just, that's a little unfair answer. But what would you go and pick? If we had time to go around, my guess is you would say things like the feeding of the 5,000 or the raising of Lazarus, or I'd love to see the parting of the Red Sea. My guess is it'd be a pattern that most of you would want to go and witness something miraculous so you could come back and tell us all about it. But here's the problem. If I come back and try to convince Nick that I had just witnessed the parting of the Red Sea, he would say, no, you hadn't. Prove it. And I can't prove it. I could tell him about it. My life has changed because I've seen it, but I'm not going to be able to really change his life. So if somebody gave me a time machine and said you can pick anything in the Bible, I'm going to narrow it down to one of two categories. Either I'm going to go back to a time when Jesus was teaching, because I'd want to watch him teach or talk or tell a story. Not that I could teach like Jesus, but I could come back and replicate some of the things that I saw. Whether I convinced you all or not that I'd done it, I could at least put some things into practice that might change our relationship. Or I would pick a conversation that Jesus had with an individual. Zacchaeus would be my number one on the list, but maybe Nicodemus. Or maybe it might be the conversation that he had with the rich young ruler. Or I'd want to just see the way he talked to somebody so that I could come back and replicate, this is how you treat somebody that the world thinks is invisible. Specifically, I would love to set my DeLorean, set the flux capacitor to go to this moment where a conversation happened by this well. because Jesus in this moment has a conversation about vertical adoration that is so basic. Now, this is not going to be a message on John 4, the whole story and unpacking the story of the Samaritan woman. We've done that from this stage, even as recently as our series on John. We've done some other series. So I'm not going to be able to cover all the nuances of what's going on with this conversation. So give me some grace to get through those parts rather quickly and jump right into it. But I rewatched this scene from The Chosen. How many of you have seen this particular scene from The Chosen, the conversation? Now, obviously, it's a fictional account. Lots of lines come straight from Scripture. But then there's obviously some liberties taken. But it's such a beautiful scene as Jesus is sitting there at the heat of noon. The woman shows up and he asks her for a drink. We're going to pick up in the story here in just a minute, but it takes place as Jesus is going from one place to the next, and it tells us that he had to go through Samaria. And geographically, you're like, well, okay, yep, you got to go through Samaria, but most people would say, nope, I'm going to cross the Jordan and go around on either side. I'm not going to go through Samaria because Jews and Samaritans did not associate. We don't have time to talk a whole lot about the Assyrians taking Jews out and putting some Assyrians in and intermarrying, and then the Samaritans were considered half-breeds. A lot of us know those things, but it's not the point of this morning. In Sychar, where this well is, it's a word that comes from a word that we think means falsehood. And so we're going to see that this woman is faced with whether or not she's going to tell the truth. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. I have to just pause for a second. My wife and I laughed about this. Every time I read a passage, I'm reading every sentence and just looking at every sentence. What's there that I'm missing? And I just found it funny that it took, I said, do you really think it took all 12 of them to go to the grocery store? And my wife was like, yes, yes. And she's like, and they're probably texting Jesus from the store going, we're here with the bread. I'm going to send you a picture, Jesus. Which of this bread do you think we need? And she's like, yeah, absolutely. It took all 12 of them. She's like, you could find 11 more guys to go to the store with you if you try. Let's move on. The Samaritan woman said to him, you're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews did not associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asked you for a drink, you'd have asked him and he would have given you living water. Now she misunderstands this because she says, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Living water to her would have meant a source or a stream of running water where she wouldn't have to come to the well. Show me how I can get access to this physical living water. And Jesus, of course, isn't talking about that. He says, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but everyone who drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become a spring of water welling up to eternal life. And the woman says, sir, give me this water so that I won't have to keep coming here to draw water. And then he stops, changes the conversation, and says, go call your husband and come back. He's about to have an appointment. The reason that I would imagine he had to go through Samaria was this moment. You realize this woman is going to become the very first missionary in all of the Gospel of John and maybe in the Jesus story. And then she says, I have no husband, she replied. And Jesus says, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. The Chosen takes it a little further, and he starts naming their names and what happened in those relationships. And she realizes something is going on. And he says, what you've said is quite true. Sir, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place that we must worship is in Jerusalem. Now, church, for years, I've thought and even taught that this woman quickly changes the subject because she doesn't want to talk about her life and her past. And so she changes the subject. And that may be true, and it very likely could be. But a friend of mine, as we talked about this story, he said, you know, I've always thought that in this story, maybe she wasn't changing the subject. Maybe she was just accelerating to a subject of great concern to her because she knows her life, she knows her reputation in the town, she knows everybody feels about it, and she's like, this guy has the answers, and he may know where I can go and quench this spot in my heart or my soul that cannot be filled. It was a very interesting thought to me. Instead of changing the subject, for example, if you're talking to a friend about faith, and they've got a life that they need to change, and they're like, yeah, but what about all the fights among denominations and churches? You settle that, and then I'll come to your church with you. Maybe she's doing that. But my friend said, maybe he is saying, this guy can do something for me that nobody else can. And I want to ask him a question. I want to get this straightened out. I want you to tell me how I am supposed to worship in a way that will fix what is so broken inside of me. Yeah, it makes sense. Jesus replied to her and he said, believe me, a time is coming when you'll worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. But a time is coming, and has now come, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now, when he says this in the Chosen, the woman is kind of confused. She looks around, and she's very confused, and she says, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming, and when he comes, he'll explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, am he. I want a time machine to go and witness that moment, because a miracle's fine, but I would rather see the look on her face. And the Chosen chose to capture it like this. I don't know what it looked like, but she says, can this be true? And then in the Chosen, there's such a great moment. She says, you've picked the wrong person. You've picked the wrong person to reveal this to. Because he says, this is the first time I've revealed myself to anybody. And she says, you picked the wrong person. He says, no, I didn't. I came here to find you. And then she says, I'm going to go and tell everybody. Does anybody remember the next line? I love it. She says, I'm going to go and tell everybody. And he looks at her right in her eyes and he says, I was counting on that. Then, leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and she said, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. You got to pause here for a minute, because you have to imagine some men in the town probably thought, everything? Okay, well, who all did she tell? Who all did he tell? Well, who all you talked to? What all did he say? This probably indicted everybody in the whole town. Could this be the Messiah? And they came out to the town, because now she understands what worship is. It's not about a where or a when. It's now about a who and about a how and about a why. And she realizes her definition of worship has been reshaped. Here's a definition that I've given you before, because for years I thought this was worship. What is worship? Well, it's this. It's all these things. And worship is this. It happens at this time in these places. That's what worship is. But I want to give us a new definition, because Jesus begins to say, no, vertical adoration is not a place you show up to and sit and passively experience something. Worship is a conviction that shapes all of life's choices so as to declare to everyone who might be aware that God is our ultimate good, and what he gives us matters more than anything we might define as essential for a meaningful life. I didn't come up with that definition. I actually pieced three definitions together, but this is one that I keep written down, because this is so much bigger than showing up and having some songs or prayer, listening to a sermon, and then going home. Just take a moment to soak this definition in. I would illustrate it by, I was in Houston several years ago, and I was told about of a guy named Stefan Bell. Stefan Bell is on a street corner and is one of the professional sign twirlers. We've seen him, right? We have him in our community as well. Except Stefan Bell works 7 days a week, 9 hours a day, had 2 30-minute lunch breaks, made $25 an hour because so many people would come to watch him do his thing. And there was some condominium in town that he was advertising. And everybody would come and watch this guy because he takes seriously his job. And it's so fun to watch him do his thing. And so when I think about vertical adoration, I just want to ask us, church, where is it that our life is pointing others to this week? Is it pointing to something in us or something that's going on that we do together? Because we come this morning and we say the word, church. We congregate. We're here, that's great. We're congregating. And then we're even going to communicate. I'm doing that now. You did that in classes. You'll do that in small groups. We communicate. Those things we do most every Sunday. And if we're spinning our sign, those things point horizontally. When I communicate or I congregate, I'm celebrating my relationship with you. Now, I know we're talking about heavenly things. We're here for a heavenly purpose, but it's largely horizontal. So then if we take it vertically as one of our first things, and then we celebrate, that could still be horizontal, but we're celebrating. Then we contemplate. And then there's a level of where we commemorate. And then we consecrate. These things don't just happen on a Sunday morning. They happen Monday all the way through Saturday. And here's the problem. So many of us come to church to congregate and communicate, to learn enough about Jesus to fill up our brains so that we don't have to think about him for the rest of the week until next Sunday we come together. And Paul would say, you've missed the point. See, church, the goal is that we gather each week to share in publicly, horizontally, what we should have been doing privately all week long. That will change a church. when people get together, not just to learn the thing they need to learn, but when they get back together and report, here's all the things that God has been doing to and through and in and in spite of me over the past week. So here's an easier definition that I've sometimes given to our students. We worship God every time we act differently because of what God has done for us. Every time. Not just in a church. Not just I'm like raising my hands, or I worship when I sing, or I worship when I pray. I worship every time I act differently because of what God has done for us. And we illustrated that with some of our seniors on Dollar Day. I told you about it last time I preached. We were about to go do it, maybe even a couple of weeks after that. We took some money that was donated by many of you. We had $1,500. We turned it into 15 $100 gift cards, and we went to a Kroger late at night for about an hour and a half, and the seniors spread out, and they found people to stop at the checkout scanner and say, "We want to pay for your groceries." "Well, why are you doing that? What's the catch? What do you need from me?" And watching our students, church, say, "There is no catch. We're loving you because Jesus first loved us, and we just want to love you in the name of Jesus." We met a guy who had just lost his job that day. Another lady comes to the store who had just lost her mom. Another person comes. This lady ran a daycare where she said, "I feed some kids and their parents can't afford to send them to a larger daycare." And she goes, I didn't even drive to Walmart where I normally go, but I came here because I didn't have enough gas to get to Walmart. And I thought, we're not going to be able to have meat in our meal this week. I got to choose electricity over meat for the kids that I'm helping to watch." And so we're like, "Not tonight." So they went and they loaded up her cart where she had plenty of food. Somebody else came in and had been at the hospital with their child. And one of our students said, "Isn't it odd that God brought all these people here in the hour and a half that we chose to be at this Kroger tonight?" And another one said, "Maybe that's the way it works, but it could be that everybody that comes in this store every hour has something that's heavy and burdening them." And that's probably more accurate. Both could be true. Everybody that walks in there has something in their soul, like a woman coming to a well who says, "I cannot give any vertical adoration because my life is so empty." And then watching all of these prayers take place right there in Kroger Church was a blessing, because these students said, I worship anytime I act differently because of what God has done. What they did that night was worship. So we have this passage here. And to wrap up, I've got four volunteers that I've asked, come and take your place in these seats. I just want to tell a story about them as we get ready to end, and I think they're here in the room, so just come on up and take your seats. I want us to look at this passage as they're coming up to get their places. John 4, the end of the story, tells us, "Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did." Church, I just want to make sure you see that highlighted passage, because this is the effect. Her vertical adoration results in some horizontal changes. And this is the one that I want us to play out here. I've chosen four random folks. I called them last week and said, "Hey, I'm picking you because you like everybody in the room, you represent influence in a certain sphere." Let me make this make sense. Let's look at this passage from John 4. Many of the, say the word church, the next word. Many of the Samaritans believed in because of. Okay. So now I'm going to give you some homework to do in your small groups, or to go when you eat today, or when you're sitting around the dinner table, lunch table, or in your car on the way to school. Sixth graders can do this, and those of you that are older can do this as well. We're going to now flip this around, and it's going to be now you 1 verse 1. Many of the, we're going to start in with Parker. Parker plays soccer at Central Magna. He's on the soccer team. So Parker goes in the last blank because of Parker's testimony. But what is it, what is the effect of him being on the soccer team, many of the soccer players at Central, what did they do with Jesus because of his testimony? Kennedy is a cheerleader at Stewart's Creek. And so many of the cheerleaders on her squad at Stewart's Creek, what is it that they do with Jesus because of her testimony? Daniel works, rotates with others to work with the juvenile detention facility here in town, to work with some of the inmates there and to share the gospel with them. What is it that they do with Jesus because of his testimony? I asked Maria to come up here because David and Maria's vision for the Barnabas Vision, the underserved in our community, they not only get their physical needs met, but they come to know Jesus because of their testimony. I just picked four. I could have just randomly selected any four from almost any pew and found four stories of people who have a circle of influence. The people I work with at the bank, the people that line up beside me on the football team, the people in my third period class, the moms that I have Mother's Day out with, the guys that I talk to over the fence after we mow the yard. It could be any group. So I want you to find a group. You find your own group when you're doing this at home, and you're going to figure out, okay, because of my life and my vertical adoration, pointing the sign to God, the rock of great value, what effect does that have on other people? Many of the Samaritans believed in Jesus because of the woman's testimony. Y'all, this woman was the most unlikely of missionaries, and if you say, yeah, I can't do that, you're doing like she did when she said, you picked the wrong person. And Jesus says, no, I picked the right person. And she says, I'm going to go tell everybody. And he says, I was counting on it. You know what? The soccer team, Jesus is counting on it. He's counting on Parker. The cheerleaders at Stewart's Creek, he's counting on Kennedy. Those young men that find themselves in juvenile detention, he's counting that Daniel is going to go and tell everyone. The people in our community that are poor and have physical needs to be met and spiritual needs, he's counting on it. I'm going to have them stay up here for a second because I want you to see yourselves in them as we begin to land this. Peter writes, as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him. You get that, church? There's a rock that the world says there's no value in that rock, and we have to convince that it's precious. It's very challenging. I was a pushover on Christmas morning, but the world is tougher. You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ. What is worship in spirit and in truth? Remember our last series, the Unwrapped series? Present your bodies as living sacrifices, for this is your spiritual act of worship. And so, I've chosen four living stones that represent all of us. They're no better than anybody else in the room. They may be a reminder, though, to some of us that our lives are pointing to something else. And so, anyone who trusts in him will never be put to shame. You, church, are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. What? That you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Parker's doing that with a soccer team. Kennedy's doing that with cheerleaders. Daniel's doing that with guys in our community in the juvenile detention facility. And Maria and David and the team at Barnabas Vision and many of you are doing that, exactly what is being said here. So end with a story of Matt. Matt lost his father-in-law and experienced such deep grief. He found it difficult to get up in the morning because he said, I was in such grief, I could not take the next step. I was trying to console my wife. I could not figure out how to move. I was dealing with some depression, some anger, some anxiety. And a friend of his said, hey, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to begin to make a list of all the things that you have to praise God for. And I want you to make a list of 10,000 of them. And he was like, what do you mean? He said, Matt, if you wake up any day and you can't find some reason to praise God, the problem is not with God. The problem is with you. The pipeline of his blessings is always flowing, but you've cut it off somehow. So I want you to make a list. So Matt started doing that. Matt went and he started with Psalm 103. And when he saw these words, bless the Lord, O my soul, all that is within me, bless his holy name. He said, I began to write. And within an hour, in less than 60 minutes, Matt Redman had written the words to the song 10,000 Reasons. He said, it's the fastest song I ever wrote because I realized there are a lot of reasons. That word 10,000, we see it in Revelation. John says, I looked and I heard the voice of many angels surrounding the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. And some people would argue this is the largest number that is mentioned in the Bible. And this word, revabah, this Hebrew word, which means 10,000, is essentially an exaggerated word that just means too numerous to count. Like we would say a kajillion. 10,000 is a number that when you hear it, it doesn't mean 10,000. It just means it's too numerous to count. And he says the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands upon thousands. And what were they doing, church? They were saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and all as such are in the sea and all that are in them, I heard saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb forever and ever. So church, it is difficult to know how to put first things first. And that's why we gather here each week. That's the message of this. And so I put before you just four people who I think are doing that. They don't always do it well, and they would say there's days where they don't do it at all. But may they be a reminder to you to put first things first and let your vertical adoration point everybody in your community so that they will come and put their faith in Jesus because of your testimony. And eventually it says that the people said, "We no longer believe just because of what you said, but now we've heard him for ourselves." And that's my prayer, that you will help somebody else this week put first things first. It's not within my power to place the divine teachings of God directly into the heart of another person. All I can do is lay them on the surface of your heart so that when your hearts break, which it will, these things be the first to fall in. And if that happens in any way, may God and God alone receive all the glory. Church, we're about to sing the words that Matt Redman wrote to bring himself up out of his grief. So let's think about the 10,000 reasons we have to praise him. Vertical adoration. Let's stand and let's sing.